Hi folks, this is Ru.
And Dave.
Welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
So today we're continuing with Chapter 15, A Tempest in the School Teapot, from the book of Anne of Green Gables by Ellen Montgomery.
Cue the music. So, you know, we started so many of these podcasts discussing the weather, and I think, why go off-brand? Today is the hottest day in quite a while.
Yep, and very, very windy. So we're getting hot, windy day.
Gross.
It's disgusting. And
you know, my ability to form words is diminished.
Yes, I also.
So this should be a rather fun podcast.
Oh, we're gonna just stumble.
And I say that in the most ironic fashion I can muster.
Yes.
See, the wrong words are coming.
It's fine.
The wrong words are coming. So,
yes,
so it's been a while on our end since we've recorded. So a quick recap before we jump in is that I believe in the last episode, in the last chapter, in fact, because we've been doing two chapters per episode. And from what I understand, you said today that might be not the case.
No, it's a long chapter. Because it is Anne's first time in school, and since she's just had a crisis with that was resolved with Marilla,
and the brooch,
the case of the mystery missing brooch, which was solved by Marilla finding the brooch on a piece of shawl.
She broached the topic in the wrong way, you might say.
Yes.
A ho.
Oh, yes, but so that idea of. Actually, just a commentary on the style. She writes, you know how a book usually builds up to a crisis, like what we had with 1984, builds up to a crisis, and then it forms a resolution. As to whether we like the resolution or not is a whole nother discussion, but...
And I was going to make the joke where, it does build up to a crisis, but every part of that book is a crisis.
Well, every part of that book is contributing and building and describing the crisis. But... With this one, you're getting little tiny, like you're getting crisis, solution. Like it's probably why it's so engaging, because you do get that immediate satisfaction of, oh, this is a, you know, it's a situation. And then, it was solved.
It's very emblematic of Anne's disposition in general as her temper flares and then everything's okay.
Yes, it's very similar, and which, yeah, you could argue is an indicator, a reflection of the emotional dysregulation of that. That makes sense. But yes, we are going to now, I believe, find out how Anne fares on her first day in school in this community that is somewhat... Let's take a wild stab, given that Tempest came up.
I think everything's going to go so well.
It's so smooth. No problems whatsoever. No conflict. No possible clash of maybe a lack of experience of dealing with individuals of a certain mindset. You know, it's never going
to
happen.
And, you know, kids are always the best. They're never mean to each other.
They're never mean to people who are other, who have, you know, say, look different to them and...
Are outsiders of the community.
Yes, we know. Anyway, so that was a whole bunch of sarcasm for anyone who has difficulty parsing sarcasm.
Actually, you know, that's become a genuine concern personally over, I'd say, maybe the last year. My delivery has gotten so dry that people don't know when I'm joking anymore. And of course, when you have to say you're joking, or if you explain a joke, it just makes everything worse.
Yeah, or it improves the situation, because then they're not confused and misunderstanding you as a person. But yes, dry humor, we will add disclaimers. Only because I have trouble with sometimes parsing certain humor as well. But yes. So, A Tempest in the School Teapot. What a splendid day. Okay, it's not obviously describing our weather right now, but... Going back. For Anne. What a splendid day, said Anne, drawing a long breath. Isn't it good just to be alive on a day like this? I pity the people who aren't born yet for missing it. That must be some day. Like, it must be really nice. They may have good days, of course, but they can never have this one. And it's splendider still to have such a lovely way to go to school by, isn't it? It's a lot nicer than going round by the road. That is so dusty and hot, said Diana practically, peeping into her dinner basket and mentally calculating if the three juicy toothsome raspberry tarts reposing there were divided among 10 girls, how many bites each girl would have. She's apparently good at maths. The little girls of Avonlea School always pooled their lunches, and to eat 3 raspberry tarts all alone, or even to share them only with one's best chum, would have forever and ever branded as awful mean the girl who did it. And yet, when the tarts were divided among 10 girls, you just got enough to tantalize you. The way Anne and Diana went to school was a pretty one. Anne thought those walks to and from school with Diana couldn't be improved upon even by imagination. Going around by the main road would have been so unromantic, but to go by Lover's Lane and Willowmere and Violet Vale and the Birch Path was romantic, if anything ever was. Lover's Lane opened out below the orchard at Green Gables and stretched far up into the woods to the end of the Cuthbert farm. It was the way by which the cows were taken to the back pasture and the wood hauled home in winter. Anne had named it Lover's Lane before she had been a month at Green Gables. Not that lovers ever really walk there, she explained to Marilla, but Diana and I are reading a perfectly magnificent book, and there's a Lover's Lane in it, so we want to have one too. And it's a very pretty name, don't you think? So romantic. We can't imagine the lovers into it, you know. I like that lane because you can think out loud there without people calling you crazy. And, starting out alone in the morning, went down Lover's Lane as far as the brook. Here Diana met her, and the two little girls went up the lane under the leafy arch of maples. "Maples are such sociable trees," said Anne. "They're always rustling and whispering to you," until they came to a rustic bridge. Then they left the lane and walked through Mr. Barry's back field and past Willowmere. Beyond Willowmere came Violet Vale, a little green dimple in the shadow of Mr. Andrew Bell's big woods. "Of course there are no violets there now," Anne told Marilla, "but Diana says there are millions of them in the spring. Oh, Marilla, can't you just imagine you see them? It actually takes away my breath. I named it Violet Vale. Diana says she never saw the beat of me for hitting on fancy names for places. It's nice to be clever at something, isn't it? But Diana named the Birch Path. She wanted to, so I let her. But I'm sure I could have found something more poetical than plain Birch Path. Anybody can think of a name like that. But Birch Path is one of the prettiest places in the world, Marilla." It was. Other people besides Anne thought so when they stumbled onto it. It was a little narrow, twisting path winding down over a long hill straight through Mr. Bell's woods, where the light came down, sifted through so many emerald screens that it was as flawless as the heart of a diamond. See, I would have said emerald, but that's just me. I'm going to have a little comment on Ella Montgomery's choice of words there, but let it go. It was fringed in all its length with slim young birches, white-stemmed and lissom-boughed, ferns and starflowers and wild lilies of the valley, and scarlet tufts of pigeonberries grew thickly along it. And always there was a delightful spiciness in the air, and music of bird calls, and the murmur and laugh of woodwinds in the trees overhead. Now and then you might see a rabbit skipping across the road if you were quiet, which, with Anne and Diana, happened about once in a blue moon. Is that a comment on the fact that they talk a lot?
Yes.
Yes, yes. Down in the valley, the path came out to the main road, and then it was just up the spruce hill to the school. Sounds like a lovely walk to school.
Mm.
Pretty, very nice.
Or even just to be able to walk to school.
Yeah. Well, yes, well. They're able to, which is nice. The Avonlea School was a whitewashed building, low in the eaves and wide in the windows, furnished inside with comfortable, substantial, old-fashioned desks that opened and shut, and were carved all over their lids with the initials and hieroglyphics of 3 generations of school children. The schoolhouse was set back from the road, and behind it was a dusky fir wood and a brook where all the children put their bottles of milk in the morning to keep cool and sweet until dinner hour. Hmm. Yeah. Natural fridge. Marilla had seen Anne start off to school on the first day of September with many secret misgivings. Anne was such an odd girl. How would she get on with the other children? And how on earth would she ever manage to hold her tongue during school hours? Things went better than Marilla feared, however. Anne came home that evening in high spirits. Okay, so it's not her first day of school, but it's within her first period of school. I think I'm going to like school here, she announced. I don't think much of the master, though. He's all the time curling his moustache and making eyes at Prissy Andrews. Prissy has grown up, you know. She's 16. Ew. She's 16, and she's studying for the entrance examination into Queen's Academy at Charlottetown next year. I'm still ewing in my head. Tilly Bolter says... oh, ew. Tilly Bolter says that the master is dead gone on her. She's got a beautiful complexion and curly brown hair, and she does it up so elegantly. She sits in the long seat at the back, and he sits there too most of the time. Okay, I'm just grossed out for a moment. Just give me a minute. Ew. Okay.
Yeah.
Even if it is, quote unquote, another time, still, ew. Yep.
Doesn't make it right.
Nope. This is one of the times we remind you of the disclaimer that this book will contain concepts and descriptions as of their time, and that we do not necessarily encourage, endorse, or agree with any of them. Thank you.
What, they couldn't tell that you don't agree with what just transpired?
No, I had to say ew 10 times. Okay, so back. So, teacher likes Prissy. Because she's... She sits in the long seat at the back, and he sits there too, most of the time, to explain her lessons, he says. But Ruby Gillis says she saw him writing something on her slate, and when Prissy read it, she blushed as red as a beet and giggled, and Ruby Gillis says she doesn't believe it had anything to do with the lesson. And Shirley, don't let me hear you talking about your teacher in that way again, said Marilla sharply. You don't go to a school to criticize the master. I guess he can teach you something, and it's your business to learn. And I want you to understand right off that you are not to come home telling tales about him. That is something I won't encourage. I hope you were a good girl. So it's I see where Marilla's coming from, but at the same time, okay, the way that it was being described by Anne was very gossipy, right? But if it had been a situation where she's like, I'm a little worried, and she knows she's open enough to share things with Marilla, but I think she maybe doesn't know how to deliver concerns and more puts it in the gossipy way that the other girls do.
I think the gossip is important because if it gets around that Anne's saying these things about certain people.
Yes. She should be discouraged from having, Marilla's standards are we don't gossip about. Especially those who've been given the responsibility of our care, we don't gossip about it. Raising valid concerns, I'm sure, would be something else, but not framed in this way.
And she seems, like most people, I imagine, very deferential to authority. You know, when Anne criticized the boring sermons of the minister, she admonished her, but in her head she's like, she's right.
Yeah, so I think we do have a little bit of this perpetuating that authoritarian kind of structure of the teacher and the students. And again, in this case, the context of the time and the isolation of the village will be relevant.
Yeah.
But yes, I agree with the fact that you don't want to have a student coming home and just gossiping. That's not helpful. But raising valid concerns is another matter entirely. So, yeah. It's a bit messy. So, indeed I was, said Anne comfortably. It wasn't so hard as you might imagine either. I sit with Diana, our seat is right by the window, and we can look down to the Lake of Shining Waters. There are a lot of nice girls in school, and we had scrumptious fun playing at dinner time. It's so nice to have a lot of little girls to play with, but of course I like Diana best. And always will. I adore Diana. I'm dreadfully far behind the others. They're all in the fifth book, and I'm only in the fourth. I feel like it's a kind of disgrace. But there's not one of them has such an imagination as I have, and I soon found out. We had reading and geography and Canadian history and dictation today. Mr. Phillips said my spelling was disgraceful, and he held up my slate so that everybody could see it, all marked over. I felt so mortified, Marilla. He might have been politer to a stranger, I think. I like her criticism there. Ruby Gillis gave me an apple, and Sophia Sloan lent me a lovely pink card with "May I see you home" on it. That's a courting card. Never mind. I'm to give it back to her tomorrow. And Tilly Boulter let me wear her bead ring all the afternoon. Can I have some of these pearl beads off the old pincushion in the garret to make myself a ring? And, oh, Marilla, Jane Andrews told me that Minnie McPherson told her that she heard Prissy Andrews tell Sarah Gillis that I had a very pretty nose. My God, what was the chain of events here? So let's go back. Wait, what? Jane Andrews told me that Minnie McPherson told her that she had heard Prissy Andrews tell Sarah Gillis that I had a very pretty nose. Wow.
I'd say it's a game of telephone, but once again, I don't think the telephone's a... made its way to the villa.
No, they've got telephones, but it's just few of them, I'd say. Now, Marilla, that is the first compliment I have ever had in my life, and you can't imagine what a strange feeling it gave me. Marilla, have I really a pretty nose? I know you'll tell me the truth. Your nose is well enough, said Marilla shortly. Secretly, she thought Anne's nose was a remarkably pretty one, but she had no intention of telling her so. She's like, no, I must keep her humble.
Well, remember, she That's worries right. that Anne is too concerned with her own appearance.
Yes, which is, I mean, fair. Mm-hmm. Fair. I mean, although a nice compliment when someone never really received one. But I think she's really, really care. She doesn't want to ruin Anne by her poor raising. Mm. So she's extremely strict in that sense.
And I guess maybe it's just me reflecting here, but what an odd compliment.
Well, no, because it might be a thing that you can imagine. It's something that's promoted amongst girls and women as a thing. And it's not because of girls and women, but because literally publications, magazines, they existed at the time as well. They constantly fixate on how they look and how they behave, right? And if you have that from a very young age onwards, I mean, this is something that even affects us now. This constant fixation on how you look, how you appear, how you behave is drilled into girls from a very young age.
Well, maybe it's also like the idea of complimenting someone their nose. I've always felt I have a very big nose, so I've ashamed by it.
Well, no, I mean, I went to, so side note, my one of my brothers was married in China. And not just like, not in one of the big cities on the side, like the ones everyone knows, Shanghai and Beijing. We're talking bang smack in the middle of China. So it was quite, by Chinese terms, rural. I can't even remember how big the city is. The entire province has 30 million people.
Yeah.
And that's considered a small province.
Yeah.
I'm just letting that sink in. Now, when we were there and we'd be walking around, my brothers and I, we can look a little bit like some of the ethnicities that are present within China, but then we also have we look different enough to stand out. And at the time, I think there was something like 16 foreigners or something in the province, and that included our wedding party.
Right.
And the wedding party being, I think we were like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I think we were 8. There was 8 of us that were, you know, quote unquote foreigners.
Right.
Or something like that. It was kind of interesting. But we would go into, getting to the nose thing, we'd go into the market, and whilst we were waiting, people would come and they'd kind of look and they'd stare at us. And then randomly, you get someone going, pointing to their nose and giving the thumbs up and saying, "Penhal, Penhal." Right? And we were going, what's going on? We asked my sister-in-law afterwards. And so the town itself has about 2.8 million people, which maybe this would have been about 10 years ago, maybe slightly less. But that idea of randomly being approached in the market and someone pointing to your nose and saying "Penhal," which means nice, like it looks good. And you're going, what? Like, it was a very surreal moment.
Was that like the first compliment you've ever got to your nose?
It's one of the it's outside of a parent.
Sorry, I just want to step outside myself right now and realize we're having a very odd conversation.
We're having a very strange conversation. Anne of Green Gables, the discussion of the nose, the compliments to nose. No, it's a thing, and people do obsess about it in general society. And comparatively to, say, surgically altered noses, which, by the way, huge surgery.
Yes, that's a huge thing. People get their noses done.
Yeah, all the time. And it's not restricted to Western societies. It's, globally speaking, it's one of the most common forms of surgery that exist.
And it sounds like a dreadful surgery.
It I've seen videos. I don't want to see videos again. I never really want to have anything that restructures my bone in my nose, which I don't need. So we've had a discussion about it, like, because my background is Persian, and within my family, we also have some serious honkers in terms of the schnoz. We have some schnoz in the fam. And
that was such a delicate way to put it.
Oh, look, I love my family. It's just that we're very open and honest about the fact that, just like with most Persian families, there's a risk of schnoz, and it's a thing. We have striking noses, okay? Mm-hmm.
Remarkable noses.
Feature noses. But from the family, I've got comparatively a relatively straight one, and a relatively, it's not too big, not too small kind of. Like, so it's not one that one would surgically alter. I know, I feel stupid talking about, sorry, I feel very silly talking about my nose. But Anne is talking about it. It's related to the topic. But I haven't received compliments on it per se. Like, I've never had what happened in China ever happen to me anywhere, mm-hmm. except where I think I got asked once, oh, have you ever had a nose operation? And I'm like, no, why? Like, it was strange because it's such a culturally accepted thing within certain pockets of society.
Right.
So they're like, wait, no, so this isn't surgical, that's your natural nose? I'm like, yeah. And they're like, oh, well, you're lucky. Actually, that's the word they use. You're so lucky.
You know, thinking more abstractly, I guess it is, it's the only part of our face that is outward. I guess ears as well.
Yeah, well, no, it's something that we're continuously receiving a narrative.
It's right in the middle of our face.
Yeah, it does make or break features. I mean, things like your jawline and other things also. But there's such a fixation on it within our concepts of aesthetics. And then depending on where you grow up, what media you're surrounded with, your perception of what is and isn't an attractive nose changes as well.
Of course, yeah.
And so it's surreal when you think about the fact that we have an entire branch. I mean, we have an entire branch of medical modification dedicated to appearance, and then there's elective surgery specifically due to aesthetic perceptions that differ over time, culture, perception, media influence, and all these things that happen. And you're going, and then you come back to this, you know, the setting in the early 1900s where there wouldn't have been this option of surgically altering your nose. And so you've got this young girl who's going, oh, everyone is fixated with appearance, how your hair looks, how your face looks, how your complexion is, how your whatever.
And she's, her whole life told her that her red hair is a problem.
Yeah, her anything that has to do with her appearance, she's scrawny, she's right. Redhead. You're bad, you've got freckles and redhead because you're a bad person kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or because you have these things, you must be a bad person. I mean, it's nothing compared to the racial violence and abuse that people receive, no.
But look, any time someone puts you down for your appearance, which generally is something you can't help because that's the way you were born.
Well, the thing is, in this mindset, they still have that mindset that your appearance is a reflection of who you are as a person.
Yeah, they've attached value to
Yes,
it.
There's value. And you know what? How much, now I postulate this question, how much have we really changed?
No, we haven't.
We haven't. We still associate.
Standards of beauty have changed.
Yes.
Shifted, I should say.
Yes, our perception of what is and isn't beautiful, depending on where you live, depending on, again, as I said, social, blah, 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 media, everything. But in terms of, do we still have a heavy value and heavy bigotry and heavy everything based on how people look?
Oh, heck yes.
Yes. And so not even opening the can of worms that is racial, racial anti-Semitic relations to certain features, it gets messy. It's a huge can of worms. So let's go back to the fact that Anne has now received a compliment. She feels it's the first compliment she's ever really received regarding her appearance. And we heard before, she was complimented on her ability to come up with names.
Yeah.
Yeah? And that she has an imagination. Also great. But that she was told her nose looks pretty, and that even then Marilla's going, I don't want her to focus so much on her appearance. I agree that she has a aesthetically pleasing nose, but I'm going to just keep it simple. So that was a very loud and very expanded discussion on the fact that...
On noses.
On noses, but more in depth about the fact that we... Even then and even now, we have this narrative of associating value with someone's appearance and their value being gauged on how they look.
Yeah.
which is sad because, as you said, a lot of the time we can't control these things.
Yeah.
Or we become pressured to control these things.
Yeah, there's even, I'm again searching for the right words, but yeah, that in more nerdy circles, especially among teenagers and people in their 20s, there's a problem with personal hygiene.
Yep.
But, and you know, if someone looks like they haven't showered and they stink a bit, that's obviously like a snap judgment you make on them. But yep. Then as I've grown older and see what an epidemic depression and anxiety is, especially amongst our generation, that seems to, you know,
it's a thing. I've compassion.
I forgot where I was going, but it's this idea that it's not that. I guess we tend to think of, you know, if someone doesn't at least do the basics to take care of their appearance, yeah. that again, it's a snap value judgment.
So I think what we can take from this is that it's not that we discourage you from engaging in personal hygiene practices. Please do if you think. But at the same time, when someone doesn't, there's often a reason, and to be more compassionate and aware that people have, there's a reason. Maybe they can't afford the flipping water bill.
Or, you know, how we look down on the homeless.
Yep.
I mean, that's tied up in a lot of other things, but you know, when you see someone disheveled sitting on the side of the street, yeah. there is that the initial, and even though it's such a horrible word, I feel it's honest, so I have to say it, initial revulsion.
Well, yes. Look, no human, we have a lot of instinctive programming to try and protect us from. It's like generations and generations of us realizing that, oh, okay, when we keep clean, then there's less disease. If we don't keep clean, there's more disease. So we've that's kind of been programmed into most of us by now.
True.
And so our initial reaction comes from that, but also being influenced by the social values placed we're constantly bombarded with this narrative of what you have defines who you are.
Yes.
Like, constantly. So when you see someone who has very little or materially pretty much nothing, we have to kind of pause and go, okay, why am I reacting this way to this person,
instead of the snap judgment, they have a little, therefore they're not worth anything.
Yeah. So it's how much of what's informing our snap judgments, and actually dissecting that and addressing it, and getting to know people for who they are as opposed to how we perceive them. I think that's a huge one. And I think that's what's now going to be happening with the Anne.
Okay.
Because
we've gone off track enough.
I think so too. But like, we've got Anne, and now it's been three. So that was 3 weeks ago. So that was 3 weeks ago where we've had this. Oh, first day of school. Okay. So 3 weeks into school. That was 3 weeks ago. And all had gone smoothly so far. And now this crisp September morning, Anne and Diana were tripping blithely down the birch path. Two of the happiest little girls in Avonlea. "I guess Gilbert Blythe will be in school today," said Diana. "He's been visiting his cousins over in New Brunswick all summer, and he only came home Saturday night. He's awfully handsome, Anne. And he teases the girls something terrible. He just torments our lives out." Diana's voice indicated that she rather liked having her life tormented out than not. So here's a side note, that whole idea of if they tease you, they like you, yep. That narrative, boys will be boys. "Gilbert Blythe," said Anne, "isn't his name that's written up on the porch wall with Julie Bells and a big take notice over them?" "Yes," said Diana, tossing her head, "but I'm sure he doesn't like Julia Bell so very much. I've heard him say he studied the multiplication table by her freckles." "Oh, don't speak about freckles to me," implored Anne. "It isn't delicate when I've got so many. But I do think that writing take notices up on the wall about boys and girls is the silliest ever. I should just like to see anybody dare to write my name up with a boy's. Not, of course," she hastened to add, "that anybody would." Anne sighed. She didn't want her name written up, but it was a little humiliating to know that there was no danger of it. "Nonsense," said Diana, whose black eyes and glossy tresses had played such havoc with the hearts of Avonlea schoolboys that her name figured on the porch walls in half a dozen take notices. "It's only meant as a joke. And don't you be too sure your name won't ever be written up. Charlie Sloane is dead gone on you. He told his mother, mind you, that you were the smartest girl in school. That's better than being good looking. Freaking Diana, she's so indelicate. Great. No, it isn't, said Anne, feminine to the core. I'd rather be pretty than clever. And I hate Charlie Sloane. I can't bear a boy with goggle eyes. If anyone wrote my name up with his, I'd never get over it. Diana Barry. Actually, there's a comment there. I'd rather be pretty than clever. Because pretty is more popular and more acceptable than clever. And especially when you're a girl.
And it's easier to get through life.
It's easier to get through life. You're not going to be criticized as much. Yeah.
Same with guys. Yeah. Handsome.
Well, yes. But when a boy is clever, he's not going
to
get...
It's easier.
Well, he's not going to get the condemnation from pretty much every level of society. In this setting. We're not talking now, we're talking in that setting. I'm not going to go into the now, because the now is too messy.
Yeah. Of course, being pretty and clever, that's the ideal.
Well, yes and no. Even if you were pretty and clever in those days, and even to some extent now, but even in those days, it's questionable as to whether that would be attractive, because immediately she's a bit got a smart mouth on her.
Right.
You know, it's messy. So it's debatable. But here we've got Anne, feminine, quote unquote, feminine to the core. I'd rather be pretty than clever. And I hate Charlie Sloane. I can't bear a boy with goggle eyes. If anyone wrote my name up with his, I'd never get over it, Diana Barry. But it is nice to keep head of your class. So, again, it's interesting that she's also got these ingrained things of judging by appearance. It's
boy with glasses? No, thank you.
I don't think it's with glasses. It's goggle eyes. I think he's actually got protruding eyes like
that. Oh, okay.
Which indicates a family history of some sort of thyroid issues. But let's drop that. Anyway. You'll have Gilbert in your class after this, said Diana. And he's used to being head of his class, I can tell you. He's only in the fourth book, although he's nearly 14. 4 years ago, his father was sick, and he had to go out to Alberta for his health, and Gilbert went with him. They were there 3 years, and Gil didn't go to school hardly until they came back. You won't find it so easy to keep head after this, Anne. So she's currently top of her grade, obviously. I'm glad, said Anne quickly. I couldn't really feel proud of keeping head of little boys and girls of just 9 or 10. I got up yesterday spelling ebullition. Josie Pye was head, and, mind you, she peeped in her book. Mr. Phillips didn't see her. He was looking at Prissy Andrews, but I did. I just swept her with a look of freezing scorn, and she got red as a beet and spelt it wrong after all. Those Pye girls are cheats all round, said Diana indignantly, as they climbed the fence of the main road. Gertie Pye actually went and put her milk bottle in my place in the brook yesterday. Did you ever? I don't speak to her now. When Mr. Phillips was in the back of the room, hearing Prissy Andrews' Latin, Diana whispered to Anne, "That's Gilbert Blythe, sitting right across the aisle from you, Anne. Just look at him and see if you don't think he's handsome." Anne looked accordingly. She had a good chance to do so, for the said Gilbert Blythe was absorbed in stealthily pinning the long yellow braid of Ruby Gillis, who sat in front of him, to the back of her seat. He was a tall boy with curly brown hair, roguish hazel eyes, and a mouth twisted into a teasing smile. Presently, Ruby Gillis started up to take a sum to the master. She fell back into her seat with a little shriek, believing that her hair was pulled out by the roots. Everybody looked at her, and Mr. Phillips glared so sternly that Ruby began to cry. Gilbert had whisked the pin out of sight and was studying his history with the soberest face in the world. But when the commotion subsided, he looked at Anne and winked with inexpressible drollery. Okay, so he's mean, but
yep.
in what is considered the acceptable way that one is mean at the time. Ugh. I think your Gilbert Blythe is handsome, confided Anne to Diana, but I think he's very bold. It isn't good manners to wink at a strange girl. But it was not until the afternoon that things really began to happen. Mr. Phillips was back in the corner explaining a problem in algebra to Prissy Andrews, and the rest of the scholars were doing pretty much as they pleased, eating green apples, whispering, drawing pictures on their slates, and driving crickets harnessed to strings up and down the aisle. What?
driving crickets harnessed to strings.
So they took crickets and they put string on them and they're...
walking them like dogs? I
think. Apparently that seems to be. Yeah, it's interesting. There was no TV in this time. No smartphones either. Anyway. Gilbert Blythe was trying to make Anne Shirley look at him and failing utterly because Anne was at that moment totally oblivious not only to the very existence of Gilbert Blythe but of every other scholar in Avonlea School itself. With her chin propped up on her hands and her eyes fixed on the blue glimpse of the Lake of Shining Waters that the west window afforded, she was far away in a gorgeous dreamland, hearing and seeing nothing save her own wonderful visions. Gilbert Blythe was not used to putting himself out to make a girl look at him and meeting with failure. She should look at him, that red-haired Shirley girl with the little pointed chin and the big eyes that weren't like the eyes of any other girl in Avonlea School. Gilbert reached across the aisle and picked the ends of... Oh, no. Gilbert reached across the aisle, picked up the end of Anne's long red braid, held it out at arm's length, and said in a piercing whisper... Carrots! Carrots! Then Anne looked at him with a vengeance. She did more than look. She sprang to her feet, her bright fancies fallen into cureless ruin. She flashed one indignant glance at Gilbert from eyes whose angry sparkle was swiftly quenched in equally angry tears. "You mean, hateful boy!" she exclaimed passionately. "How dare you!" And then, thwack! Anne had brought her slate down on Gilbert's head and cracked it, slate, not head, clear across. Avonlea School always enjoyed a scene. This was an especially enjoyable one. They like the drama.
Mm.
It's like Twitter. Anyway, everybody said, oh, in horrified delight. Diana gasped. Ruby Gillis, who was inclined to be hysterical, began to cry. Tommy Sloan let his team of crickets escape him altogether while he stared open-mouthed at the tableau. Mr. Phillips stalked down the aisle and laid his hand heavily on Anne's shoulder. "Anne Shirley, what does this mean?" he said angrily. Anne returned no answer. It was asking too much of flesh and blood to expect her to tell before the whole school that she had been called Carrots. Gilbert it was who spoke up stoutly. "It was my fault, Mr. Phillips. I teased her." Mr. Phillips paid no heed to Gilbert. "I am sorry to see a pupil of mine displaying such temper and such a vindictive spirit," he said in such a solemn tone, as if the mere fact of being a pupil of his ought to root out all evil passions from the hearts of small imperfect mortals. "Anne, go and stand on the platform in front of the blackboard for the rest of the afternoon." Anne would have infinitely preferred a whipping to this punishment, under which her sensitive spirit quivered as from a whiplash. With a white set face, she obeyed. Mr. Phillips took a chalk crayon and wrote on the blackboard above her head, "Anne, A-N-N, Shirley, has a very bad temper. Anne Shirley must learn to control her temper," and then read it out loud so that even the primer class who couldn't read writing should understand it. Anne stood there for the rest of the afternoon with that legend above her. She did not cry or hang her head. Anger was still too hot in her heart for that, and it sustained her amid all her agony of humiliation. With resentful eyes and passion-red cheeks, she confronted alike Diana's sympathetic gaze and Charlie Sloane's indignant nods and Josie Pye's malicious smiles. As for Gilbert Blythe, she would not even look at him. She would never look at him again. She would never speak to him. When school was dismissed, Anne marched out with her red head held high. Gilbert Blythe tried to intercept her at the porch door. "I'm awfully sorry I made fun of your hair, Anne," he whispered contritely. "Honest, Diane, don't be mad for keeps now." Anne swept by disdainfully, without look or sign of hearing. "Oh, how could you, Anne?" breathed Diana as they went down the road, half reproachingly, half admiringly. Diana felt that she could never have resisted Gilbert's pleas. "I shall never forgive Gilbert Bly," said Anne firmly, "and Mr. Phillips spelt my name without an E, too. The iron has entered..." I love that. It's like, my name.
Oh, no, I'm laughing at the next line. Go ahead.
The iron has entered into my soul, Diana.
So dramatic.
She's so dramatic. I mean, fair. Sore point. But no. And it's also unjust. It's unjust. It's really not fair that... Please tell me. Yeah, sorry. It's not fair that Gilbert, when he spoke up to take responsibility, was dismissed because, oh, it's a boy. Like, you could tell. It was a case of she's the new one, she's different, she's the outsider, and she's a she.
Yeah. Very cool. I mean, you know, the extent of her temper is a problem.
It is a problem, definitely. And it's not excusing the violence.
But yes, for Gilbert to get off scot-free and to actually, for the book also to make us feel sympathetic because he wants to make up to her.
Well, sympathetic, yes and no. I think it's trying to indicate that Gilbert did learn that that was not the way to go and that was not right and actually is now maybe examining I think it's trying to indicate it's making him examine his behavior.
He probably had nobody ever respond to him like
yes
that.
No one's probably taken him to task. The girls just kind of titter and go, oh well, it's just a boy,
or cry like the girl who had her brain pinned.
Yeah, and no one's actually confronted him about it probably, and the fact that she's confronted him, and I mean seriously confronted him about something he's done when he's done something wrong, is probably one of the first times he's been addressed. And you can tell that the teachers don't address it,
mm-hmm.
because even when he admits it, and I think he's probably recognized that, why is she being punished and I'm not being punished? Well, we're putting a lot of faith in him right now, but
yes,
the fact that
again, maybe we're giving him too much credit just because he's
well, we're giving him a lot of credit, given the fact that the author is writing. I would say yes to encourage sympathy towards him. But at the same time, there's probably...
Well, I'm just thinking maybe she didn't want to turn him into a villain. Maybe he's not a villain. Because, well, I'm reading a fantasy series at the moment, and it seems wherever the main character goes, there's always one character in the town or the area that hates him. And it's very easy. It made me realize, oh, that's actually a really simple trope. You know, you just... We're behind the main character, even for all their faults. So if you set someone up against them for whatever reason, we're going to be on the main character's side.
Well, here's the thing that it also said. It's like Mr. Phillips, it gives you an idea of the attitude. Mr. Phillips is kind of going, I'm sorry to see that a pupil of mine would be like this. And the author writes, he says in such a solemn tone, as if the mere fact of being a pupil of his ought to root out all evil passions from the hearts of small, imperfect mortals. And so it's emphasizing the lack of perfection that you see in these children.
And yet he's chatting up a 16-year-old.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. Now, Diana, the iron has entered into my soul, Diana. Diana hadn't the least idea what Anne meant, but she understood it was something terrible. "You mustn't mind Gilbert making fun of your hair," she said soothingly. "Why, he makes fun of all the girls. He laughs at mine because it's so black, and he's called me a crow a dozen times, and I've never heard him apologize for anything before either." Yeah, this is the first time he's actually had to take account. "There's a great deal of difference between being called a crow and being called carrots," said Anne with dignity. "Gilbert Blythe has hurt my feelings excruciatingly, Diana." It is possible the matter might have blown over without more excruciation if nothing else had happened, but when things begin to happen, they are apt to keep on. Avonlea scholars often spent noon hours picking gum in Mr. Bell's spruce grove over the hill across his big pasture field. From there, they could keep an eye on Eben Wright's house where the master boarded. When they saw Mr. Phillips emerging therefrom, they ran for the schoolhouse, but the distance being about three times longer than Mr. Wright's lane, they were very apt to arrive there, breathlessly and gasping, some 3 minutes too late. On the following day, Mr. Phillips was seized with one of his spasmodic fits of reform and announced before going home to dinner that he should expect to find all the scholars in their seats when he returned. Anyone who came in late would be punished. All the boys and some of the girls went to Mr. Bell's spruce grove as usual, fully intending to stay only long enough to pick a chew. It's a chewing gum, spruce mm-hmm. gum, yep. But spruce groves are seductive, and yellow nuts of gum beguiling. They picked and loitered and strayed, and as usual, the first thing that recalled them to a sense of flight of time was Jimmy Glover shouting over the top of a patriarchal old spruce, "Master's coming." The girls who were on the ground started first and managed to reach the schoolhouse in time, but without a second to spare, the boys who had to wriggle hastily down from the trees were later, and Anne, who had not been picking gum at all, but was wandering happily in the far end of the grove, waist-deep among the bracken, singing softly to herself, with a wreath of rice lilies in her hair, as if she were some wild divinity of the shadowy places, was latest of all. So she got distracted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anne could run like a deer, however, and run she did, with the impish result that she overtook the boys at the door and was swept into the schoolhouse among them, just as Mr. Phillips was in the act of hanging up his hat. Mr. Phillips' brief reforming energy was over. He didn't want the bother of punishing a dozen pupils, but it was necessary to do something to save his word, so he looked about for a scapegoat and found it in Anne, who had dropped into her seat, gasping for breath, with a forgotten lily wreath hanging askew over one ear, and giving her a particularly rakish and dishevelled appearance. "Anne Shirley, since you seem to be so fond of the boys' company, we shall indulge your taste for it this afternoon," he said sarcastically. "Take those flowers out of your hair and sit with Gilbert Blythe." The other boys snickered. Diana turned pale with pity, plucked the wreath from Anne's hair, and squeezed her hand. Anne stared at the master as if turned to stone. "Did you hear what I said, Anne?" queried Mr. Phillips sternly. "Yes, sir," said Anne slowly. "But I didn't suppose you really meant it." "I assure you I did," still with a sarcastic inflection, which all the children and Anne especially hated. It flicked on the roar. "Obey me at once." For a moment, Anne looked as if she meant to disobey. Then, realizing that there was no help for it, she rose haughtily, stepped across the aisle, sat down beside Gilbert Blythe, and buried her face in her arms at the desk. Ruby Gillis, who got a glimpse of it as it all went down, told the others going home from school that she'd actually never seen anything like it. It was so white, with awful little red spots in it. So she was definitely not happy.
Mm.
To Anne, this was the end of all things. It was bad enough to be singled out for punishment from among a dozen equally guilty ones. It was worse still to be sent to sit with a boy, but that boy should be Gilbert Blythe, who was heaping insult on injury to a degree utterly unbearable. Anne felt that she could not bear it, and it would be of no use to try. Her whole being seethed with shame and anger and humiliation. At first, the other scholars looked and whispered and giggled and nudged. But as Anne never lifted her head, and as Gilbert worked fractions as if his whole soul was absorbed in them and them only, they soon returned to their own tasks, and Anne was forgotten. When Mr. Phillips called the history class out, Anne should have gone, but Anne did not move. And Mr. Phillips, who had been writing some verses to Priscilla, before he called the class, was thinking about an obstinate rhyme still, and never missed her. Once, when nobody was looking, Gilbert took from his desk a little pink candy heart with a gold motto on it, "You are sweet," and slipped it under the curve of Anne's arm. Whereupon Anne arose, took the pink heart gingerly between the tips of her fingers, dropped it onto the floor, ground it to a powder beneath her heel, and resumed her position without deigning to bestow a glance on Gilbert. When school went out, Anne marched to her desk ostentatiously, took out everything therein, books and writing tablet, pen and ink, testament and arithmetic, and piled them neatly onto her cracked slate. "What are you taking all those things home for, Anne?" Diana wanted to know, as soon as they were on the road. She had not dared to ask the question before. "I am not coming back to school any more," said Diana. Diana gasped and stared at Anne to see if she meant it. "Will Marilla let you stay home?" she asked. "She'll have to," said Anne. "I'll never go to school to that man again." "Oh, Anne," Diana looked as if she were ready to cry. I do think you're mean. What shall I do? Mr. Phillips will make me sit with that horrid Gertie Pye. I know he will, because she is sitting alone. Oh, do come back, Anne." "I'd do almost anything in the world for you, Diana," said Anne sadly. "I'd let myself be torn limb from limb if it would do you any good. But I can't do this, so please don't ask it. You harrow up my very soul." So she's very, like, she wants to not leave her friend in the lurch, but no.
A bridge too far.
Yeah. Just think of all the fun you'll miss, mourned Diana. We're going to build the loveliest new house down by the brook, and we'll be playing ball next week, and you've never played ball, Anne. It's tremendously exciting. And we're going to learn a new song. Jane Andrews is practicing it up now. And Alice Andrews is going to bring a new pansy book next week, and we're all going to read out loud chapter about down by the brook. And you know you're so fond of reading out loud, Anne. Nothing moved Anne in the least. Her mind was made up. She would not go to school to Mr. Phillips again. She told Marilla so when she got home. Nonsense, said Marilla. It isn't nonsense at all, said Anne, gazing at Marilla with solemn, reproachful eyes. Don't you understand, Marilla? I've been insulted. Insulted fiddlesticks! You'll go to school tomorrow as usual. Oh, no. Anne shook her head gently. I'm not going back, Marilla. I'll learn my lessons at home, and I'll be as good as I can be, and hold my tongue all the time if it's possible at all. But I will not go back to school, I assure you. Marilla saw something remarkably like unyielding stubbornness looking out of Anne's small face. She understood she would have trouble in overcoming it, but she resolved wisely to say nothing more just then. I'll run down and see Rachel about it this evening, she thought. There's no use reasoning with Anne now. She's too worked up, and I have an idea she can be awful stubborn if she takes the notion. Far as I can make out from her story, Mr. Phillips has been carrying matters with a rather high hand, but it would never do to say so to her. I'll just talk it over with Rachel. She's sent 10 children to school, and she ought to know something about it. She'll have heard the whole story, too, by this time.
Of course she will.
Yes. Marilla found Mrs. Lynde knitting quilts as industriously and cheerfully as usual. I suppose you know why I've come about, she said a little shamefacedly. Mrs. Rachel nodded. About Anne's fuss in school, I reckon, she said. Tilly Boulter was on her way home from school and told me about it. I don't know what to do with her, said Marilla. She declares she won't go back to school. I never saw a child so worked up. I've been expecting trouble ever since she started going to school. I knew things were going too smooth to last. She's so high-strung. What do you advise, Rachel? Well, since you've asked my advice, Marilla, said Mrs. Lynde amiably. Mrs. Lynde dearly loved to be asked for advice. I'd just humour her a little at first. That's what I'd do. It's my belief that Mr. Phillips was in the wrong. Of course, it doesn't do to say so to the children, you know. And of course, he did right to punish her yesterday for giving way to temper. But today it was different. The others who were late should have been punished as well as Anne, that's what. And I don't believe in making girls sit with the boys for punishment. It isn't modest. Tilly Boulter was real indignant. She took Anne's part right through and said all the scholars did, too. Anne seems real popular among them somehow. I never thought she'd take with them so well. See, she's bright and imaginative and clever, and they appreciate that.
And she stood up to Gertie.
She stood up to Gertie, but she also, Josie Pye, sister.
No, the boy.
Gertie's
not. Gilbert, boy. Sorry.
Gilbert, yeah, she stood up to Gilbert. She's also someone, you know, you see, she can imagine how they must feel.
Mm-hmm.
So she has empathy. She has a lot of sincere empathy and compassion, which I think that is new for them. Then you really think I'd better let her stay home? Said Marilla in amazement. Yes. That is, I wouldn't say school to her again until she said it herself. Depend upon it, Marilla. She'll cool off in a week or so and be ready enough to go back of her own accord. That's what. While if you were to make her go back right off, dear knows what freak or tantrum she'd take next and make more trouble than ever. The less fuss made, the better, in my opinion. She won't miss much by not going to school, as far as that goes. Mr. Phillips isn't any good at all as a teacher. The order he keeps is scandalous, that's what, and he neglects the young fry and puts all his time on those big scholars he's getting ready for Queen's. He'd never have got the school for another year if his uncle hadn't been a trustee, the trustee, for he just leads the other two around by the nose, that's what. I declare, I don't know what education in this island is coming to. Mrs. Rachel shook her head, as much as to say if she were the only head of the educational system of the province, things would be much better managed. Marilla took Mrs. Rachel's advice, and not another word was said to Anne about going back to school. She learned her lessons at home, did her chores, and played with Diana in the chilly purple autumn twilights. But when she met Gilbert Bligh on the road or encountered him in his Sunday school, she passed him by with an icy contempt that was no whit thawed by his evident desire to appease her. Even Diana's efforts as a peacemaker were of no avail. Anne had evidently made up her mind to hate Gilbert Bligh to the end of her life. As much as she hated Gilbert, however, she did love Diana with all the love of her passionate little heart, equally intense in its likes and dislikes. One evening, Marilla, coming up from the orchard with a basket of apples, found Anne sitting along by the east window in the twilight, crying bitterly. "Whatever's the matter now, Anne?" she asked. "It's about Diana," sobbed Anne luxuriously. "I love Diana so, Marilla. I cannot ever live without her. But I know very well, when we grow up, that Diana will get married and go away and leave me. And, oh, what shall I do? I hate her husband. I just hate him furiously. I've been imagining it all out, the wedding and everything. Diana dressed in snowy garments with a veil and looking as beautiful and regal as a queen, and me the bridesmaid with a lovely dress too and puff sleeves, but with a breaking heart hid beneath my smiling face. And then bidding Diana goodbye." Here Anne broke down entirely and wept with increasing bitterness. "They're 12.
Yep.
11, 12, what's going on?"
Well, Anne doesn't do anything by halves, no, even her imagination.
Marilla turned quickly away to hide her twitching face. But it was no use. She collapsed on the nearest chair and burst into such a hearty and unusual peal of laughter that Matthew, crossing the yard outside, halted in amazement. When he had heard Marilla... When had he heard Marilla laugh like that before?
Anne's finally cracked her.
Yes, she's finally done it. "Well, Anne Shirley," said Marilla as soon as she could speak, "if you must borrow trouble, for pity's sake, borrow it handier home. I should think you had an imagination, sure enough."
And that's the end. What a lovely end.
It's like, you can tell that she really, 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 really loves her friend. And it's just funny. It's just so funny.
But, to the bit that got me was, "And I hate her husband."
She's 12, and I already hate her husband that doesn't exist yet.
Yep.
Oh, child. So I understand, like, for her, she's obviously feeling lonely as well, and that would make it.
Yeah, because she's not at school. She's in self-imposed exile.
Yes, so she's made it probably a little, she's made it worse for herself.
Of course.
I liked how the author, the chapter is written away saying, like, had she not experienced, she experienced to some extent justice for the breaking of her temper,
mm-hmm.
with some minor injustice because
Gilbert didn't get anything.
Yeah, but then the next day she experiences it again.
Well, complete injustice.
Injustice, and she's picked on essentially.
Yep.
And you're going,
I must admit, Rachel rose very highly in my estimation when she put forth her opinions on the headmaster and the way the school is run.
Yes, and the fact that she's like, it's nepotism. It's straight up nepotism. Like, that's why he's got this job. It's not because he actually should have this job. And the fact that everyone in town apparently knows about the fact that he just ignores the students he should be looking after for the attention of the girls going to Queens.
And also, like, the idea of, as a punishment, making the girls sit among the boys.
Well, the thing is, it shouldn't be a punishment. They need to form healthy, natural relationships because eventually they're going to depend on each other in society. So being sat with someone else as a punishment?
Well, what I mean is, obviously, because Rachel Lynn thinks it improper.
She's thinking of it as in terms of
the time, yeah.
It's modesty. And it is. It's a humiliation. And the fact that Anne was humiliated 2 days in a row.
And I think probably what tipped her over the edge was because he was right next to her. Gilbert handed her a love note.
A candy heart. He was trying to apologize without actually letting her space to process her anger.
Mm.
And then whilst in the middle of a new humiliation.
Yeah.
Yeah, not good.
Lifted her over the edge.
Yeah, that was the flip.
That was a thoroughly enjoyable chapter.
Yes.
So and just a single one.
Just a single one, but it was a big chapter, but also we got a little sidetracked with nasal discussion. But yeah, still.
Oh, yeah, there's, what, 10 minutes on noses in the middle of this episode?
Yes, yes.
Well, you know what they say, the nose knows.
Oh, God. But yes, on that note, we're going to wrap up because we're going to go over time and we would like to continue.
True, true. So the music at the start of the episode was Avonlea by Haggard Hardy.
And at the end, we've got I Am the Slime by Frank Zappa.
You can find myself on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
And you can find me at Rue McMoo and our podcast at
SMB SLT Podcast on Facebook and Twitter. Please give us some feedback if you'd like. You can find us on the Facebook page or on Twitter. Please, if you are enjoying the podcast, leave a review on iTunes or wherever else you can leave a review these days. Yeah. I'm not quite sure which podcast networks allow
reviews. I think it is mainly iTunes. I'm not sure. But
look, I think Spotify you can...
You can like or you can dislike or you can
favorite. Yeah.
However you wish to provide your feedback, we are open to it. You can also actually email us at... Yep, it is smbsltpodcast@gmail.com.
And, you know, if you are enjoying what we do, please share it with your friends, with people you think might enjoy reading and discussion of literature, even though, you know, we're just in the middle of a second book.
Yeah, and we're not professional, so it's kind of, it's chill, it's very casual. So, yeah. Thank you, and...
Yeah, until next episode, enjoy your reading, everybody.
Bye.